declaration came from Menyon, who had again risen to his feet to face the others. "I came with Shay this far to be certain he reached the safety of Cullhaven, which he has done. My duty to him is finished, but I owe it to my homeland and to my people to protect them in any way I can." "What can you offer, then?" asked Alanon abruptly, astonished that the Highlander would volunteer without first speaking to his friends. Shay and Flick were clearly dumbfounded by this unexpected announcement. "I'm the best bowman in the Southland," Menyon answered smoothly. "Probably the best tracker as well." Alanon seemed to hesitate for a moment, then looked to Balinor, who quietly shrugged. For a brief moment, Menyon and Alanon locked gazes, as if to judge each other's intentions. Menyon smiled coldly at the grim historian. "Why should I answer to you?" he queried shortly. The dark figure at the other end of the table stared at him almost curiously, and a deathly silence settled over the company. Even Balinor stepped back one short pace in shock. Shane knew instantly that Menyon was asking for trouble, and that everyone at the table except the three companions knew something about the foreboding Alanon. They did not. The frightened Veilman shot a quick look at Flick, whose flushed face had gone pale at the thought of a confrontation between the two men. Desperate to avoid any trouble, Shay stood up suddenly and cleared his throat. Everyone looked in his direction, and his mind went blank. "You have something to say?" demanded Alanon blackly. Shay nodded, and his mind raced desperately, knowing what was expected. He looked again to Flick, who managed a barely perceptible nod indicating that he would go along with whatever his brother decided. Shay cleared his throat a second time. "My special skill appears to be that I was born in the wrong family, but I had better see this matter through. Flick and I, Menyon, too, will go to Paranor." Alanon nodded his approval and even managed a slight smile, inwardly pleased with the young Veilman. Shay, more than any of the others, had to be strong. He was the last son of the House of Shannara, and the fate of so many would depend on that single, small chance of birth. At the other end of the table, Menyon Lee relaxed quietly in his seat, a barely audible sigh of relief escaping his lips as he silently congratulated himself. He had deliberately provoked Alanon, and in so doing had forced Shay to come to his rescue by agreeing to go to Paranor. It had been a desperate gamble to induce the little Veilman to make up his mind that he was going with them. The Highlander had come close to what might have been a fatal confrontation with Alanon. He had been lucky. He wondered if luck would smile on all of them during the journey ahead. Chapter 9. Shay stood quietly in the darkness outside the assembly hall and let the night air wash over his hot face in cool waves. Flick was immediately to his right, the broad face grim in the shadowed moonlight. Menyon leaned idly against a tall oak some yards off to their left. The meeting had concluded, and Alanon had asked them to wait for him. The tall wanderer was still inside, making preparations with the dwarf elders to counter the expected invasion from the Upper Anar. Balinor was with them, coordinating the defense of the famed Border Legion in distant Callahorn with that of the dwarf army of the Eastland. Shay was relieved to be out of the stuffy little room, out in the open night where he could consider more clearly his hasty decision to go with the company to Paranor. He knew, and he guessed Flick must have known as well, that they could not expect to stay out of the inevitable conflict centering around the Sword of Shannara. They could have stayed in Cullhaven, living almost like prisoners, hoping that the dwarf people would protect them from the searching skullbearers. They could have stayed in this strange land, apart from all who knew them, perhaps forgotten in time by everyone except the dwarfs. But to alienate themselves that way would have been worse than any imaginable fate at the hands of the enemy. For the first time, Shay realized that he must accept the fact, finally and forever, that he was no longer merely the adopted son of Curzad Ohmsford. He was a son of the elven House of Shannara, the son of kings and the heir to the fabled sword, and though he would have wished it otherwise, he must accept what chance had decreed for him. He looked quietly at his brother, who stood lost in thought, staring at the darkened earth, and he felt a keen pang of sorrow at the remembrance of the other's loyalty. Flick was courageous and loved him, but he had not bargained for this unexpected turn of events that would take them into the heart of the enemy's country. Shay did not want Flick to be involved in this matter. It was not his responsibility. He knew that the stocky Veilman would never desert him so long as he felt he could help, but perhaps now Flick could be persuaded to remain behind, even to return to Shady Vale to explain to their father what had befallen them. But even as he toyed with the idea, he discarded it, knowing that Flick would never turn back. Whatever else happened, he would see this matter through. "There was a time," Flick's quiet voice broke into his thoughts, "when I would have sworn that I would live out my life in uneventful solitude in Shady Vale. Now it appears that I will be a part of an effort to save mankind." "Do you think I should have chosen otherwise?" Shay asked after a moment's silent thought. "No, I don't think so." Flick shook his head. "But remember what we talked about on the trip here, about things being beyond our control, even our understanding? You see how little control we now have over what's to become of us." He paused and looked squarely over to his brother. "I think you made the right choice, and whatever happens, I'll be with you." Shay smiled broadly and placed a hand on the other's shoulder, thinking to himself that this was exactly what he had predicted Flick would say. It was a small gesture, perhaps, but one that meant more to him than any other could have. He was aware of the sudden approach of Menyon from the other side and turned to face the Highlander. "I suppose you think me some sort of fool after what happened in there tonight," Menyon stated abruptly. "But this fool stands along with old Flick. Whatever happens, we'll face it together, be it mortal or spirit." "You caused that scene in there to get Shay to agree to go, didn't you?" an irate Flick demanded. "That's the lowest trick I have ever witnessed." "Never mind, Flick," Shay cut him short. "Menyon knew what he was doing, and he did the right thing. I would have decided to go anyway. At least I'd like to believe I would. Now we've got to forget the past, forget our differences, and stand together for our own preservation." "As long as I stand where I can see him," retorted his brother bitterly. The door to the conference room opened suddenly, and the broad figure of Balinor was silhouetted in the torchlight from within. He surveyed the three men standing just beyond him in the darkness, then closed the door and walked over to them, smiling slightly as he approached. "I'm glad you decided to come with us. All of you," he stated simply. "I must add, Shay, that without you, the trip would have been pointless. Without the heir of General Shannara, the sword is only so much metal." "What can you tell us about this magic weapon?" Menyon asked quickly. "I'll leave that to Alanon," replied Balinor. "He plans to speak with you here in just a few minutes." Menyon nodded, inwardly disturbed at the prospect of encountering the tall man again that evening, but curious to hear more about the power of the sword. Shay and Flick exchanged quick glances. At last they would learn the full story behind what was happening in the Northland. "Why are you here, Balinor?" Flick asked cautiously, not wishing to pry into the Borderman's personal affairs. "It's a rather long story. You would not be interested," replied the other almost sharply, immediately causing Flick to believe he had overstepped his bounds. Balinor saw his chagrined look and smiled reassuringly. My family and I have not been on very good terms lately. My younger brother and I have had a disagreement, and I wanted to leave the city for a while. Alanon asked me to accompany him to the Anar. Hendel and the others were old friends, so I agreed. Sounds like a familiar tale, commented Menyon dryly. I've had some problems like that myself from time to time. Balinor nodded and managed a half-smile, but Shay could tell from his eyes that he did not consider this a laughing matter. Whatever had caused him to leave Callahorn was more serious than anything Menyon had ever encountered in Lee. Shay quickly changed the subject. What can you tell us about Alanon? We seem to be placing an unusual amount of trust in him, and we still know absolutely nothing about the man. Who is he? Balinor arched his eyebrows and smiled, amused by the question and, at the same time, uncertain as to how it should be answered. He walked away from them a little, thinking to himself, and then turned back abruptly and motioned vaguely toward the assembly hall. I really don't know much about Alanon myself, he admitted frankly. He travels a great deal, exploring the country, recording in his notes the changes and growth of the land and its people. He's well known in all the nations. I think he's been everywhere. The extent of his knowledge of this world is extraordinary. Most of it isn't in any book. He is very remarkable. But who is he? Shay persisted eagerly, feeling that he must learn the true origin of the historian. I can't say for certain, because he has never confided completely, even in me. And I am almost like a son to him, Balinor stated very quietly, so softly, in fact, that they all moved a bit closer to be certain they missed nothing of what was to follow. The elders of the dwarfs and of my own kingdom say that he is the greatest of the druids, that almost forgotten council that governed men over 1,000 years ago. They say that he is a direct descendant of the druid Bremen, perhaps even of Gallifile himself. I think there is more than a little truth in that statement, because he went to Perenor often and stayed for long periods, recording his findings in the great record books stored there. He paused for a moment, and his three listeners glanced at each other, wondering if the grim historian could actually be a direct descendant of the druids, thinking in awe of the centuries of history behind the man. Shay had suspected before that Alanon was one of the ancient philosopher teachers known as druids, and it seemed apparent that the man possessed a greater knowledge of the races and the origins of the threat facing them than did anyone else. He turned back to Balinor, who was speaking again. I can't explain it, but I don't believe we could be in better company for any peril, even were we to come face to face with the warlock lord himself. Though I haven't one shred of concrete evidence, nor even an example to cite you, I'm certain that Alanon's power is beyond anything we have ever seen. He would be a very, very dangerous enemy. Of that, I haven't the slightest doubt, Flick muttered dryly. Only minutes later, the door of the conference room opened and Alanon stepped quietly into view. In the half-light of the moon, he was huge and forbidding, almost a replica of the dreaded skull-bearers they feared so much, the dark cape billowing slightly as he moved toward them, his lean face hidden in the depths of the long cowl about his head. They were silent as he approached, wondering what he would tell them, what it would mean for them in the days ahead. Perhaps he knew their thoughts instinctively as he walked up to them, but their eyes could not pierce the mask of inscrutability that cloaked his grim features and sheltered the man buried within. They could only see the sudden glint of his eyes as he stopped before them and looked slowly from one face to the next. A deep silence settled ominously over the little group. The time has come for you to learn the full story behind the Sword of Shannara, to learn the history of the races, as only I know it to be. His voice reached out and drew them commandingly to him. It is essential that Shay should understand, and since the rest of you share the risks involved, you should also know the truth. What you will learn tonight must be kept in confidence until I tell you it no longer matters. This will be hard, but you must do it. He motioned for them to follow him and moved away from the clearing, drawing them deeper into the darkness of the trees beyond. When they were several hundred feet into the forest, he turned into a small, almost hidden clearing. He seated himself on the worn stub of an ancient trunk and motioned the others to find a place. They did so quickly and waited in silence as the famous historian gathered his thoughts and prepared to speak. "A very long time ago," he began finally, still considering his explanation as he spoke, "before the great wars, before the existence of the races as we know them today, the land was, or was thought to be, populated only by man. Civilization had developed even before then for many thousands of years. Years of hard toil and learning that brought man to a point where he was on the verge of mastering the secrets of life itself. It was a fabulous, exciting time to live in, so expansive that much of it would be totally beyond your comprehension were I empowered to draw you the most perfect picture. But while man worked all those years to discover the secrets of life, he never managed to escape his overpowering fascination for death. It was a constant alternative, even in the most civilized of the nations. Strangely enough, the catalyst of each new discovery was the same endless pursuit, the study of science. Not the science the races know today, not the study of animal life, plant life, the earth, and the simple arts. This was a science of machines and power, one that divided itself into infinite fields of exploration, all of which worked toward the same two ends. Discovering better ways to live, or quicker ways to kill." He paused and laughed grimly to himself, cocking his head in the direction of the attentive Balinor. "Very strange indeed when you think about it, that man should spend so much time working toward two such obviously different goals. Even now, nothing has changed, even after all these years." His voice trailed off for a moment, and Shay risked a brief look at the others, but their eyes were fixed on the speaker. "Sciences of physical power!" Alanon's sudden exclamation brought Shay's head around with a snap. "These were the means to all the ends of that era. 2,000 years ago, the achievements of the human race were unparalleled in Earth's history. Man's age-old enemy, death, could now claim only those who had lived out their natural lifetime. Sickness was virtually eliminated, and given a bit more time, man would even have found a way to prolong life. Some philosophers claimed that the secrets of life were forbidden to mortals. No one had ever proved otherwise. They might have done so, but their time ran out, and the same elements of power that had made life free from sickness and infirmity nearly destroyed it altogether. The great wars began, building gradually from smaller disputes between a few peoples, and spreading steadily, despite the realization of what was happening, spreading from little matters into basic hatreds. Race, nationality, boundaries, creeds. In the end, everything. Then suddenly, so suddenly that few people knew what happened, the entire world was enveloped in a series of retaliatory attacks by the different countries, all very scientifically planned and executed. In a matter of minutes, The science of thousands of years, the learning of centuries, culminated in an almost total destruction of life. The Great Wars. The deep voice was grim, the glint of the dark eyes watching carefully the faces of his listeners. Very apt name. The power expended in those few minutes of battle not only succeeded in wiping out those thousands of years of human growth, but it also began a series of explosions and upheavals that completely altered the surface of the land. The initial force did most of the damage, killing every living thing over 90% of the face of the earth, but the after effects carried on the alteration and extinction, breaking the continents apart, drying up oceans, making lands and seas uninhabitable for several hundred years. It should have been the end of all life, perhaps the end of the world itself. Only a miracle prevented that end.
"I can't believe it."
The words slipped out before Shay could catch himself, and Alanon looked toward him, the familiar mocking smile spreading over his lips. "That's your history of civilized man, Shay," he murmured darkly. "But what happened thereafter concerns us more directly. Remnants of the race of man managed to survive during the terrible period following the Holocaust, living in isolated sectors of the globe, fighting the elements for survival. This was the beginning of the development of the races as they are today. Men, dwarves, gnomes, trolls, and some say the elves. But they were always there, and that's another story for another time." Alanon had made exactly the same comment concerning the elven people to the Ohmsford brothers in Shady Vale. Shay wanted badly to stop the narration at that point to ask about the race of elves and about his own origin. But he knew better than to irritate the tall historian by breaking in, as he had several times during their first meeting. A few men remembered the secrets of the sciences that had shaped their way of life prior to the destruction of the old world. Only a few remembered. Most were little more than primitive creatures, and the few could recollect only bits and pieces of knowledge. But they had kept their books of learning intact, and these could tell them most of the secrets of the old sciences. They kept them hidden and secure during that first several hundred years, unable to put the words to practical use, waiting for the time when they might. They read their precious texts instead, and then, as the books themselves began to crumble with age, and there was no way to preserve them or copy them, those few men who possessed the books began to memorize the information. The years passed, and the knowledge was passed down carefully from father to son, each generation keeping the knowledge safely within the family, guarding it from those who didn't use it wisely, who might create a world in which the great wars could happen a second time. In the end, even after it once again became possible to record the information in those irreplaceable books, the men who had memorized them declined to do so. They were still afraid of the consequences, afraid of each other, and even themselves. So they decided, individually for the most part, to wait for the right time to offer their knowledge to the growing new races. The years passed in this way as the new races slowly began to develop beyond the stage of primitive life. They began to unify into communities, trying to build a new life out of the dust of the old. But as you have already been told, they did not prove equal to the task. They quarreled violently over land, petty disputes which soon turned to armed conflict between the races. It was then when the sons of those who had first kept the secrets of the old life, the old sciences, saw that matters were steadily regressing toward the very thing that had destroyed the old world, that they decided to act. The man called Gallifile saw what was happening and realized that if nothing were done, the races would surely be at war. So he called together a select group of men, all he could find who possessed any knowledge of the old books, to a council at Paranor. "So that was the first druid council," murmured Menyon Lee in wonder. "A council of all the knowledgeable men of that era, pooling their learning to save the races." "A very praiseworthy effort at explaining, a desperate attempt to prevent extermination of life," laughed Alanon shortly. "The druid council was formed with the best intentions on the part of most, perhaps all at first. They exerted a tremendous influence over the races because they were capable of offering so much to make life considerably better for everyone. They operated strictly as a group, each man contributing his knowledge for the benefit of all. Although they succeeded in preventing an outbreak of total war and kept peace between the races at first, they encountered unexpected problems. The knowledge that each possessed had become unavoidably altered in small ways in the telling from generation to generation, so that many of the key understandings were different than they had been. Complicating the situation was an understandable inability to coordinate the different materials, the knowledge of the different sciences. For many of the council members, the learning passed down to them by their ancestors lacked meaning in practical terms, and much of it appeared to be so many jumbled words. So while the druids, as they called themselves after an ancient group who sought understanding, were able to aid the races in many ways, they found themselves unable to piece together enough out of the texts they had memorized to master readily any of the important concepts of the great sciences, the concepts they felt certain would help the country to grow and prosper. "Then the druids wanted the old world rebuilt on their terms," spoke up Shay quickly. "They wanted to prevent the wars that had destroyed them the first time, yet recreate the benefits of all the old sciences." Flick shook his head in bewilderment, unable to see what all this had to do with the warlock lord and the sword. "Correct," Alanon noted. "But the druid council, for all its vast knowledge and good intentions, overlooked a basic concept of human existence. Whenever an intelligent creature possesses an innate desire to improve its conditions, to unlock the secrets of progress, it will find the means to do so, if not by one method, then by another." The druids secluded themselves at Paranor, away from the races of the land, while they worked alone or in small groups to master the secrets of the old sciences. Most relied on the material at hand, the knowledge of individual members related to that of the entire council, to try to rebuild and reconstruct the old means of harnessing power. But some were not content with this approach. A few felt that, instead of trying to understand the words and thoughts of the ancient recollections better, such knowledge as could be immediately grasped should be acted upon and developed in connection with new ideas, new rationalizations. So it was that a few members of the council, acting under the leadership of one called Broner, began to delve into the ancient mysteries without waiting for a full understanding of the old sciences. They had phenomenal minds, genius in a few instances, and they were eager to succeed, impatient to master the power that would be so useful to the races. But by a strange quirk of fate, their discoveries and their developments led them further and further from the studies of the council. The old sciences were puzzles without answers for them, and so they deviated into other fields of thought, slowly and relentlessly intertwining themselves in a realm of study that none had ever mastered, and none called science. What they began to unveil was the infinite power of the mystic. Sorcery. They mastered a few of the secrets of the mystic before they were discovered by the council and commanded to abandon their work. There was a violent disagreement, and the followers of Brona left the council in anger, determined to continue their own approach. They disappeared and were not seen again. He paused for a moment, considering his explanation. His listeners waited impatiently. We know now what happened in the years that followed. During his prolonged studies, Brona uncovered the deepest secrets of sorcery and mastered them. But in the process, he lost his own identity, eventually even his own soul, to the powers he had sought so eagerly. Forgotten were the old sciences and their purpose in the world of man. Forgotten was the Druid Council and its goal of a better world. Forgotten was everything but the driving urge to learn more of the mystic arts, the secrets of the mind's power to reach into other worlds. Brona was obsessed with the need to extend his power, to dominate men and the world they inhabited through mastery of this terrible force. The result of this ambition was the infamous First War of the Races, when he gained domination over the weak and confused minds of the race of man, causing that hapless people to make war on the other races, subjecting them to the will of the man who was no longer a man, who was no longer even the master of himself. And his followers, asked Minion slowly, victims of the same. They became servants to their leader, all slaves of the strange power of sorcery. Al-Anon trailed off hesitantly, as if to add something, but uncertain of its effect on his listeners. Thinking better of it, he continued. The fact that these unfortunate druids stumbled onto the very opposite of what they were seeking is in itself a lesson to man. Perhaps with patience they might have pieced together the missing links to the old sciences, rather than uncovering the terrible power of the spirit world that fed eagerly on their unprotected minds until they were devoured. Human minds are not equipped to face the realities of non-material existence on this sphere. It is too much for any mortal to bear for long. Again he trailed off into ominous silence. The listeners now understood the nature of the enemy they were trying to outwit. They were up against a man who was no longer a human, but the projection of some great force beyond their own comprehension, a force so powerful that Al-Anon feared it could affect the human mind. The rest you already know, Al-Anon began again rather sharply. The creature called Brona, who no longer resembled anything human, was the directing force behind both of the race wars. The Skull-Bearers are the followers of their old master Brona, those druids once human in form, once a part of the council at Perenor. They cannot escape their fate any more than he can. The very forms they take are an embodiment of the evil they represent. But more important for our purposes, they represent a new age for mankind, for all the people of the four lands. While the old sciences have disappeared into our history, forgotten now as completely as the years when machines were the godsend of an easy life, the enchantment of sorcery has replaced them. A more powerful, more dangerous threat to human life than any before it. Do not doubt me, my friends. We live in the age of the sorcerer, and his power threatens to consume us all. There was a moment of silence. A deep stillness hung oppressively in the forest night as Al-Anon's final words seemed to echo back with ringing sharpness. Then Shay spoke softly. What is the secret of the Sword of Shannara? In the First War of the races, Alanon replied in almost a whisper. The power of the druid Brona was limited. As a result, the combined might of the other races, coupled with the knowledge of the druid council, defeated his army of men and drove him into hiding. He might have ceased to be, and the whole incident been written off as merely another chapter in history. Another war between mortals. Except that he managed to unlock the secret of perpetuating his spiritual essence long after his mortal remains should have decomposed and turned to dust. Somehow he preserved his own spirit, feeding it on the power of the mystic forces he now possessed, giving it a life apart from materiality, apart from mortality. He now was able to bridge the two worlds, the world we live in and the spirit world beyond, where he summoned the black wraiths that had for centuries lain dormant and waited for his time to strike back. As he waited, he watched the races drift apart as he knew they must in time, and the power of the druid council wane as their interest in the races grew lax. As with all things evil, he waited until the balance of hatred, envy, greed, the human failings common to all the races, outweighed the goodness and kindness. And then he struck. Gaining easy control of the primitive, warlike rock trolls of the Charnel Mountains, he reinforced their numbers with creatures of the spirit world he now served, and his army marched on the divided races. As you know, they crushed the druid council and destroyed it, all save a few who fled to safety. One of those who escaped was an aged mystic named Bremen, who had foreseen the danger and in vain attempted to warn the others. As a druid, he was originally a historian, and in that capacity had studied the First War of the Races and learned of Brona and his followers. Intrigued by what they had attempted to do, and suspicious that perhaps the mysterious druid had acquired powers that no one had known about, nor could have hoped to combat, Bremen began his own study of the mystic arts. But with greater care and respect for the possible power he felt he might unlock, after several years of this pursuit, he became convinced that Brona was indeed still existent, and that the next war upon the human race would be started and eventually decided by the powers of sorcery and black magic. You can imagine the response he received to this theory. He was practically thrown from the confines of Perenor. As a result, he began to master the mystic art on his own, and so was not present when the castle at Perenor fell to the troll army. When he learned that the council had been taken, he knew that if he did not act, the races would be left defenseless against the enchantment Brona had mastered, power that mortals knew nothing about. But he was faced with the problem of how to defeat a creature who could not be touched by any mortal weapon, one who had survived for over 500 years. He went to the greatest nation of his time, the elven people under the command of a courageous young king named Gerald Shannara, and offered his assistance. The elven people had always respected Bremen, because they understood him better than even his fellow druids. He had lived among them for years prior to the fall of Perenor, while studying the science of the mystic. "There is something I don't understand," Balinor spoke up suddenly. "If Bremen was a master of the mystic arts, why could he not himself challenge the power of the warlock lord?" Alanon's response was somehow evasive. "He did confront Brona in the end on the plains of Strelaheim, though it was not a battle that was visible to mortal eyes, and both disappeared. It was presumed that Bremen had defeated the spirit king, But time has proven otherwise. And now... He hesitated only an instant before quickly returning to his narrative, but the emphasis on the pause was not lost on any of his listeners. In any event, Bremen realized that what was needed was a talisman to serve as a shield against the possible return of one such as Brona at another time, when there was no one familiar with the mystic arts to offer assistance to the peoples of the Four Lands. So he conceived the idea of the sword, a weapon which would contain the power to defeat the warlock lord. Bremen forged the sword of Shannara with the aid of his own mystic prowess, shaping it with more than the mere metal of our own world, giving it that special protective characteristic of all talismans against the unknown. The sword was to draw its strength from the minds of the mortals for whom it acted as a shield. The power of the sword was their own desire to remain free, to give up even their lives to preserve that freedom. This was the power which enabled Gerald Shannara to destroy the spirit-dominated Northland army then. It is the same power that must now be used to send the warlock lord back into the limbo world to which he belongs, to imprison him there for all eternity, to cut off entirely his passage back to this world. But as long as he has the sword, then he has a chance to prevent its power from being used to destroy him forever. And that, my friends, is the one thing that must not be. But then why is it that only a son of the House of Shannara? The question formed on Shay's fumbling lips, his own mind reeling confusedly. "That is the greatest irony of all," exclaimed Alanon before the question was even completed. "If you have followed all that I have related about the change of life following the Great Wars, the giving way of the old materialistic sciences to the science of the present age, the science of the mystic, then you will understand what I am about to explain. The strangest phenomenon of all. While the sciences of old operated on practical theories built around things that could be seen and touched and felt, the sorcery of our own time operates on an entirely different principle. Its power is potent only when it is believed, for it is power over the mind which can neither be touched nor seen through human senses. If the mind does not truly find some basis for belief in its existence, then it can have no real effect. The warlock lord realizes this, and the mind's fear of and belief in the unknown, the worlds, the creatures, all the occurrences that cannot be understood by men's limited senses, offer him more than enough basis upon which to practice the mystic arts. He has been relying on this premise for over 500 years. In the same way, the sword of Shannara cannot be an effective weapon unless the one holding it believes in his power to use it. When Bremen gave the sword to Gerald Shannara, he made the mistake of giving it directly to a king, and to the house of a king. He did not give it to the people of the lands. As a result, through human misunderstanding and historical misconception, the universal belief grew that the sword was the weapon of the elven king alone, and that only those descended of his blood could take up the sword against the warlock lord. So now, unless it is held by a son of the House of Shannara, that person can never fully believe in his right to use it. The ancient tradition that only such a one can wield it will make all others doubt. And there must be no doubt, or it will not operate. Instead, it will become merely another piece of metal. Only the blood and belief of a descendant of Shannara can invoke the latent power of the great sword. he concluded. The silence that followed was hollow. There was nothing left to tell the four that could be told. Al-Anon reconsidered briefly what he had promised himself. He had not told them everything, purposely holding back the little more that would have proved the final terror for them. He inwardly felt torn between the desire to have it all out and the gnawing realization that it would destroy any chance of success. Their success was of paramount importance. Only he knew the full truth of that fact. So he sat in silence, bitter in his private knowledge and angered by the self-imposed limits he had set for himself. The limits that forbade a complete revelation to those who had come to depend upon him so very heavily. Then only Shay can use the sword if... Balinor broke the silence abruptly. Only Shay has the birthright. Only Shay. It was so quiet that even the nightlife of the forest seemed to have stilled its incessant chatter in sober contemplation of the grim historian's reply. The future came down to each as a simple declaration of existence. Succeed or be destroyed. "Leave me now," commanded Al-Anon suddenly. "Sleep while you can. We leave this haven at sunrise for the halls of Paranor." Chapter 10 The morning came quickly for the small company, and the golden half-light of dawn found them preparing to begin their long journey with sleep-filled eyes. Balinor, Menion, and the Veilmen waited for the appearance of Al-Anon and the cousins of Eventine. No one spoke, partly because each was still half asleep and had very little to recommend him in the way of good humor, and partly because each was inwardly thinking about the hazardous trip that lay ahead. Shay and Flick sat quietly on a small stone bench, not looking at each other as they considered the tale Al-Anon had related to them the previous night, wondering what possible chance they had of recovering the Sword of Shannara, using it against the warlock lord to destroy him, and still returning alive to their homeland. Shay particularly had passed the point where his chief emotion was fear. Now he felt only a sense of numbness that dulled his mind into self-imposed surrender, a robot-like acceptance of the fact that he was being led to the proverbial slaughter. Yet in spite of this resigned attitude toward the journey to Paranor, somewhere in the back of his confused mind was the lingering belief that he could work out all of these seemingly insurmountable obstacles. He could feel it lurking there, waiting for a more opportune moment to arise and demand satisfaction. But for the moment, he allowed himself to lapse dutifully into numbed acquiescence. The Veilmen were dressed in woodsman garb provided by the dwarf people, including warm half-cloaks in which they now wrapped themselves to ward off the chill of the early morning. In addition, they carried the short hunting knives they had brought with them from the Vale, tucked in their leather belts. Their packs were necessarily compact, in accord with the Veilmen's small size. The country they would pass through offered some of the best hunting in all the Southland, and there were several small communities friendly to Al-Anon and the dwarves. But it was also the home of the gnome people, the long-time bitter enemies of the dwarves. There was some hope the little band would be able to maintain an advantage of stealth and secrecy in their travel and avoid any confrontation with gnome hunters. Shay had carefully packed away the elf stones in their leather pouch, showing them to no one. Al-Anon had not mentioned them since he had arrived in Cullhaven. Whether this was an oversight or not, Shay was not about to give up the one really potent weapon that he possessed, and kept the pouch hidden within his tunic. Minyan Lee stood several yards away from the brothers, pacing idly. He wore particularly nondescript hunting clothes, loose-fitting and colored to blend with the land to make his task as tracker and huntsman as uncomplicated as possible. His shoes were soft leather, toughened by certain oils to enable him to stalk anything without being heard and still travel the toughest ground without injuring the soles of his feet. Strapped to his lean back was the great sword, sheathed now, its strong hilt glinting dully in the early light as he shifted restlessly about. Across his shoulder he carried the long ash bow and its arrows, his favorite weapon on hunting trips. Balinor wore the familiar long hunting cloak wrapped closely about his tall, broad frame, the cowl pulled up around his head. Beneath the cloak was the chainmail, which could be seen glinting sharply ever so often as his arms emerged in brief gestures from beneath the shielding of the garment. He carried in his belt a long hunting knife and the most enormous sword that the Veilmen had ever seen. It was so huge that it appeared to them that one sweep of its great blade would cut through a man completely. It was hidden beneath the cloak at the moment, but the brothers had seen him strap it to his side as he came out to them earlier that morning. Their waiting finally came to an end as Alanon approached from the assembly hall, accompanied by the lithe figures of the two elves. Without stopping, he bade them all good morning and directed them to fall into line for the trip, warning sharply that once they crossed the Silver River several miles ahead, they would be in country traveled by gnomes, and that conversation must be kept to a minimum. Their route would take them from the river directly north through the Anar forests into the mountains that lay beyond. There was less chance that they would be detected traveling through this rough country than across the plains that lay farther west, where the terrain was admittedly more even and accessible. Secrecy was the key to their success. If the purpose of their journey became known to the warlock lord, they were finished. Travel would be restricted to the daylight hours while they were camouflaged by the forests and mountains, and they would resort to night travel and risk detection by the searching skull-bearers only when they were forced to cross the plains many miles to the north. As their representative on the expedition, the dwarf chieftain had chosen Hendel, the close-mouthed fellow who had saved Menyon from the Siren. Hendel led the company out of Cullhaven, since he was the most familiar with this part of the country. At his side walked Menyon, talking only occasionally, concentrating mostly on staying out of the sullen dwarf's way and trying to avoid drawing attention to his presence, something the dwarf felt was totally unnecessary. Several paces back from them were the two elves, their slim figures like brief shadows as they moved gracefully, effortlessly, speaking with each other in quiet, musical voices that Shay found reassuring. Both carried long ash bows similar to Menyon's. They wore no cloaks, only the strange, close-fitting outfits they had worn at the council the night before. Shay and Flick followed them, and behind the Veilmen walked the silent leader of the company, his long strides covering the ground with ease, his dark face lowered to the trail. Balinor brought up the rear. Both Shay and Flick were quick to realize that their position in the center of the company was to assure their maximum protection. Shay knew how valuable the others felt he was to the success of the mission, but he was also painfully aware that they considered him incapable of defending himself in case of any real danger. The company reached the Silver River and crossed at a narrow spot where the winding thread of gleaming water was spanned by a sturdy wooden bridge. All talking ceased once they had passed over, and all eyes went to the dense forest about them, watching uneasily. The going was still relatively smooth. The ground was level as the path wound sharply through the great forest, leading them steadily northward. The light of the morning sun shone in long streamers through cracks in the heavy branches, occasionally cutting across their path and catching their faces as they walked, warming them briefly in the cool air of the forest. Beneath their feet, the fallen leaves and twigs were soaked with a heavy dew, making a cushion that masked the sound of their footsteps and helped to preserve the quiet of the day. All about them, they could hear sounds of life, though they saw only multicolored birds and a few squirrels that scampered eagerly about their treetop domains, sometimes raining the travelers below with torrents of nuts and twigs as they leaped from branch to branch. The trees prevented the members of the company from seeing much of anything, their great girth ranging from 3 to 10 feet in diameter, and their huge roots stretching out from the trunks like mammoth fingers, digging their way relentlessly into the earth of the forest floor. The view from every direction was masked, and the company had to content itself with relying on Hendel's familiarity with the country and the pathfinding knowledge of Menyan Lee to guide them through the maze of vegetation. The first day passed without incident, and they spent the night beneath the giant trees, somewhere north of the Silver River and Cullhaven. Hendel was apparently the only one who knew exactly where they were, though Alanon conversed briefly with the taciturn dwarf concerning their whereabouts and the route they were taking. The company ate its dinner cold, fearing that a fire might attract attention. But the general mood was light, and the conversation was enjoyable. Shay took this opportunity to speak with the two elves. They were cousins of Eventine, chosen to accompany Alanon as representatives of the Elven Kingdom and to aid him in his search for the Sword of Shannara. They were brothers, the elder called Durin, a slim, quiet Westlander who gave the instant impression to Shay and the ever-present Flick that he was a man to be trusted. The younger brother was Dale, a shy, extremely likable fellow who was several years the junior of Shay. His boyish charm was strangely appealing to the elder members of the company, particularly Balinor and Hendel, battle-hardened veterans of so many years of protecting the frontiers of their homelands, who found his youth and fresh outlook on life almost like a second chance for them to regain something that had passed them by years before. Durin informed Shay that his brother had left their elven home several days prior to his marriage to one of the most beautiful girls in that country. Shay would not have believed Dale old enough to marry and found it difficult to understand why anyone would leave on the eve of his marriage. Durin assured him that it had been his brother's own choice, but Shay told Flick later that he believed that his relationship to the king had much to do with that decision. So now, as the members of the company sat quietly and spoke in low tones to one another, all save the silent, aloof Hendel, Shay wondered how much the young elf regretted his decision to leave his bride-to-be to come on this hazardous journey to Paranor. He found himself wishing inwardly that Dael had not chosen to be a member of their party, but had remained safe within the protective confines of his own homeland. Later that evening, Shay approached Balinor and asked him why Dael had been allowed to come on such an expedition. The Prince of Calahorn smiled at the Veilman's concern, thinking to himself that the difference in ages between the two was hardly noticeable to him. He told Shay that in a time when the homelands of so many people were threatened, no one stopped to question why another was there to aid them. It was merely accepted. Dael had chosen to come because his king had asked it, and because he would have felt less of a man in his own mind had he declined. Balinor explained that Hendel had been waging a constant battle with the gnomes for years to protect his homeland. The responsibility was delegated to him because he was one of the most experienced and knowledgeable bordermen in the Eastland. He had a wife and family at home that he had seen once in the past 8 weeks and could not expect to see again for many more. Everyone on the journey had a great deal to lose, he concluded, perhaps even more than Shay realized. Without explaining his final remark, the tall borderman moved off to speak with Alanon on other matters. Somewhat discontented by the abrupt finish to their conversation, Shay moved back to join Flick and the elven brothers. "What kind of person is Eventine?" Flick was asking as Shay joined the group. "I've always heard that he is considered the greatest of the elven kings, respected by everyone. What is he really like?" Durin smiled broadly, and Dea laughed merrily at the question, finding it somehow amusing and unexpected. "What can we say about our own cousin?" "He is a great king," responded Durin seriously after a few moments. "Very young for a king, the other monarchs and leaders would say. But he has foresight, and most important of all, he gets things done before the time for doing them has passed. He holds the love and esteem of all the elven people. They would follow him anywhere, do anything he asked, which is fortunate for all of us. The elders of our council would prefer to ignore the other lands, to try to remain isolated, Sheer foolishness, but they're afraid of another war. Only Eventine stands against them and that policy. He knows that the only way to avoid the war they all fear is to strike first and cut off the head of the army which threatens. That is one reason why this mission is so important, to see that this invasion is checked before it has time to develop into a full-scale war. Menyon had sauntered over from the other side of the small campsite and seated himself with them just in time to hear the last comment. "What do you know of the Sword of Shannara?" he asked curiously. "Very little, actually," admitted Dale. "Although for us it's a matter of history rather than legend. The sword has always represented a promise to the elven people that they need never again fear the creatures from the spirit world. It was always assumed that the threat was finished with the conclusion of the Second War of the Races, so no one really concerned himself with the fact that the entire House of Shannara died out over the years, except for a few such as Shae, whom no one knew about. Eventine's family, our family, became rulers almost 100 years ago, the Elicidals. The sword remained at Paranor, forgotten by nearly everyone until now." "What is the power of the sword?" persisted Menyon, a little too eagerly to suit Flick, who shot Shae a warning glance. "I don't know the answer to that question," Dale admitted, and looked to Durin, who shrugged in response and shook his head. "Only Alanon seems to know that." They all looked momentarily toward the tall figure seated in earnest conversation with Balinor across the clearing. Then Durin turned to the others. "It is fortunate that we have Shae, a son of the House of Shannara. He will be able to unlock the secret of the sword's power once we have it in our possession, and with that power we can strike at the Dark Lord before he can create the war that would destroy us." "If we get the sword, you mean?" corrected Shae quickly. Durin acknowledged this comment with a short laugh of agreement and a reassuring nod. "There's still something about all this that doesn't set right," Menyon declared quietly, rising abruptly and moving off to find a place to sleep. Shae watched him go and found himself in agreement with the Highlander, but was unable to see what they could hope to do about their dissatisfaction. Right now he felt that there was so little hope of their succeeding in their quest to regain the sword that for the moment he would concentrate on simply completing the journey to Paranor. For now, he did not even want to think about what might happen after that. The company was awake and back on the winding path with the breaking of the dawn, led by a watchful Hendel. The dwarf moved them along at a rapid pace through the mass of great trees and heavy foliage that had grown increasingly dense as they penetrated deeper into the Anar. The trail was beginning to slope upward, an indication that they were approaching the mountains that ran the length of the central Anar. At some point farther north they would be forced to cross these broad peaks in order to reach the plains to the west that lay between them and the halls of Paranor. Tension began to mount as they moved more deeply into the domain of the gnome people. They began to experience the unpleasant sensation that someone was constantly watching them, hidden in the denseness of the forest, waiting for the right moment to strike. Only Hendel seemed unconcerned as he led them, his own fears apparently eased by his familiarity with the terrain. No one spoke as they marched, all eyes searching the silent forest about them. About midday, the path turned sharply upward and the company began to climb. The trees now grew farther apart and the scrub foliage was less congested. The sky became clearly visible through the trees, a deep blue unbroken by even the faintest trace of a cloud wisp. The sun was warm and bright, shining bravely through the scattered trees to light the whole of the forest. Rocks began to appear in small clusters, and they could see the land ahead rise in tall peaks and jutting ridges that signaled the beginning of the southern sector of the mountains in the central Anar. The air became steadily cooler as they climbed, and breathing became more difficult. After several hours, the company reached the edge of a very dense forest of dead pines, clustered so closely that it was impossible to see for more than 20 or 30 feet ahead at any one place. On both sides of their path, tall, slab rock cliffs rose hundreds of feet into the air and peaked against the blueness of the afternoon sky. The forest stretched several hundred yards in either direction, ending at the cliff walls. At the edge of the pines, Hendel called a brief halt and spoke for several minutes with Menyon, pointing to the forest and then the cliffs, apparently questioning something. Alanon joined them, then motioned the remainder of the company to gather around in a close circle.
"The mountains we are about to cross into are the Wolfstag, a no-man's land for both dwarf and gnome," Hendel explained quietly. "We chose this way because there was less chance of meeting up with a gnome hunting patrol, something that would certainly result in a pitched battle. The Wolfstag Mountains are said to be inhabited by creatures from another world."
"A good joke, isn't it?"
"Get to the point," Alanon broke in. "The point is," Hendel continued, seemingly oblivious of the dark historian, "we were spotted about 15 minutes back by one or possibly two gnome scouts. There may be more around, we can't be certain. The Highlander says he saw signs of a large party. In any event, the scouts will report us and bring back help in a hurry, so we'll have to move fast."
"Worse than that," declared Menyon quickly. "Those signs said there are gnomes ahead of us somewhere, through those trees or in them."
"Maybe so, maybe not, Highlander," Hendel cut back in sharply. "These trees run like this for almost a mile, and the cliffs continue on both sides, but narrow sharply beyond the forest to form the Pass of Noose, the entrance to the Wolfstag. That is the way we have to go. To try any other route would cost us 2 more days, and we would be risking an almost certain run-in with gnomes. Let's move out quickly. Once we reach the other side of the pass, we'll be in the mountains. The gnomes will not follow us there."
"Encouraging, I'm sure," muttered Flick under his breath. The company moved into the thickly clustered trees of the pine forest, following one another in single file, weaving among the rough, disjointed trunks. Dead needles lay in heaps over the whole of the earthen forest floor, creating a soft matting on which the passing of feet made no sound. The white-barked trees rose tall and lean, touching near their skeletal tops like some intricate spiderweb, lacing the blueness of the clear sky in fascinating designs. The party wound steadily forward through the maze of trunks and limbs behind Hendel, who chose their route quickly and without hesitation. They had not gone more than several hundred yards when Durin brought them up sharply and motioned for silence, looking questioningly about, apparently searching the air for something.
"Smoke!" he exclaimed suddenly. "They've set fire to the forest!"
"I don't smell any smoke," declared Menyon, sniffing the air tentatively.
"You don't have the sharpened senses of an elf either," Alanon stated flatly. He turned to Durin. "Can you tell where they've fired it?"
"I smell smoke too," declared Shay absently, amazed that his own senses were as sharp as those of the elves.
Durin cast about for a minute, trying to catch the scent of smoke from one particular direction.
"Can't tell, but it appears that they've fired it in more than one place. If they have, the forest will go up in a matter of minutes."
Alanon hesitated for one brief second, then motioned for them to continue toward the Pass of Noose. The pace picked up considerably as they hastened to reach the other side of the fire trap in which they were encased. A blaze in those dry woods would quickly cut off any chance of escape once it spread through the treetops. The long strides of Alanon and the bordermen forced Shay and Flick to run to keep from falling behind. Alanon shouted something to Balinor at one point in the race, and the broad figure dropped back into the trees and was lost from sight. Ahead of them, Menyon and Hendel had disappeared, and there were only fleeting glimpses of the elven brothers dashing smoothly between the leaning pines. Only Alanon stayed clearly in view, a few paces behind, calling to them to run faster. Thick clouds of heavy white smoke were beginning to seep between the closely bunched trunks like a heavy fog, obscuring the path ahead and making it steadily more difficult to breathe. There was still no sign of the actual fire. It had not yet grown strong enough to spread through the intertwining boughs and cut them off. The smoke was everywhere in a matter of minutes, and both Shay and Flick coughed heavily with every breath, their eyes beginning to sting from the heat and irritation. Suddenly, Al-Anon called to them to halt. Reluctantly, they stopped and waited for the order to continue, but Al-Anon appeared to be looking back for something, his lean, dark face strangely ashen in the thick, white smoke. Soon, the broad figure of Balinor reappeared from the forest behind them, wrapped tightly in the long hunting cloak. "You were right. They're behind us," he informed the historian, gasping out the words as he fought for breath. "They've fired the forest all along our backs. It looks like a trap to drive us into the Pass of Noose." "Stay with them," Al-Anon ordered quickly, pointing to the frightened Veilmen. "I've got to catch the others before they reach the pass." With incredible speed for a man so big, the tall leader leaped away and dashed into the trees ahead, disappearing almost immediately. Balinor motioned for the Veilmen to follow him, and they proceeded at a rapid pace in the same direction, fighting to see and to breathe in the choking smoke. Then, with frightening suddenness, they heard the sharp crackle of burning wood, and the smoke began to billow past them in huge, blinding clouds of white heat. The fire was overtaking them. In a few minutes it would reach them, and they would be burned alive. Coughing furiously, the three crashed heedlessly through the pines, desperate to escape the inferno in which they had been caught. Shay shot a quick glance skyward, and to his horror saw the flames leaping madly from the tops of the tall pines above and beyond them, burning their glowing way steadily down the long trunks. Then abruptly, the impenetrable stone wall of the cliffs appeared through the smoke and the trees, and Balinor motioned them in that direction. Minutes later, as they groped their way along the cliff face, they saw the remainder of the company crouched in a clearing beyond the fringe of the burning trees. Ahead lay an open trail that wound upward into the rocks between the cliffs and disappeared into the Pass of Noose. The three quickly joined the others as the entire forest was enveloped in flames. "They're trying to force us to choose between roasting in that pine forest or trying to get through the pass," shouted Al-Anon over the crackle of burning wood, looking anxiously toward the trail ahead. "They know we have only two ways to go, but they're facing the same choice, and that's where they lose the advantage. Durin, go on ahead into the pass a little way and see if the gnomes have set an ambush." The elf darted away without a sound, crouching low and keeping close to the cliff wall. They watched him until he had disappeared farther up the trail into the rocks. Shay huddled with the others, wishing that there was something he could do to help. "The gnomes are not fools," Al-Anon's voice cut into his thoughts abruptly. "Those in the pass know that they are cut off from those who fired the forest unless they can get by us first. They wouldn't risk having to retreat back through the Wolfstag Mountains for any reason. Either there is a large force of gnomes in the pass ahead, which Durin should be able to tell us, or they've got something else in mind. Whatever it is, they'll probably try it in the section called the Knot," Hendel informed them. "At that point, the trail narrows so that only one man at a time can get through the path formed by the converging cliff sides." He paused and appeared to be considering something further. "I don't understand how they plan to stop us," Balinor cut in quickly. "These cliffs are almost vertical. No one could scale them without a long and hazardous climb. The gnomes haven't had time to get up there since they spotted us." Al-Anon nodded thoughtfully, obviously in agreement with the Borderman, and unable to see what the gnomes had in store for them. Menyon Lee spoke quietly to Balinor, then abruptly left the group and moved ahead to the entrance of the pass where the cliff walls began to narrow sharply, scanning the ground intently.
The heat of the burning woods had become so intense that they were forced to move farther into the mouth of the pass. Everything was still obscured by the clouds of white smoke which rolled out of the dying woods like a wall and dispersed sluggishly into the air. Long moments passed while the six awaited the return of Menyon and Durin. They could still see the lean Highlander studying the ground at the entrance to the pass, his tall form shadowy in the smoke-filled air. Finally, he stood up and moved back to them, joined almost immediately by the returning elf.
There were footprints, but no other sign of life in the pass ahead, Durin reported. Everything is apparently undisturbed up to the narrowest point. I didn't go beyond.
There is something else, Menyon cut in quickly. At the entrance to the pass, I found two clear sets of footprints leading in and two sets out. Gnome feet.
They must have slipped in ahead of us and then out again by staying close to the cliff walls while we blundered up the middle, Balinor said angrily. But if they were in there ahead of us, what...
We won't find out by sitting here and discussing it, Alanon concluded in disgust. We would only be guessing. Hendel, take the lead with the Highlander and watch yourself. The rest stay in formation as before.
The stocky dwarf moved out with Menyon at his side, their sharp eyes keyed in on every boulder that lined the winding path as it narrowed into the pass of Noose. The others followed several paces back, casting apprehensive glances at the rugged terrain surrounding them. Shay risked one quick look behind him and noticed that, while Alanon was close on his heels, Balinor was nowhere in sight. Apparently Alanon had again left the bordermen to act as a rear guard at the edge of the burning pine forest, to watch for the inevitable approach of the gnome hunters lurking somewhere beyond. Shay knew instinctively that they were caught in a trap carefully arranged for them by the furtive gnomes, and all that remained was to discover what form it would take. The path ahead rose sharply for the first 100 yards or so, then tapered off gradually and narrowed to such an extent that there was only enough room for one person to pass between the cliff sides. The pass was no more than a deep niche in the face of the cliff, the sides slanting inward and almost closing far above them. Only a thin ribbon of light from the blue sky streamed downward to reach them, faintly lighting the winding, boulder-laden path ahead. Their progress slowed perceptibly as the lead men searched for traps left by the gnomes. Shay had no idea how far Durin had gone in his scouting mission, but apparently he had not ventured into what Hendel had referred to as the Knot. He could guess where the name had originated. The narrowness of the passage left the sharp impression of being drawn through the knot of a hangman's noose to the same fate as that which awaited the condemned. He could hear Flick's labored breathing almost in his ear and experienced an unpleasant feeling of suffocation at the closeness of the rock walls. The group moved slowly onward, slightly bent to avoid the narrowed cliff sides and their razor-sharp stone projections. Suddenly, the pace slowed further and the whole line crowded together. Behind him, Shay heard the deep voice of Alanon muttering angrily, demanding to know what had happened, asking excitedly to be led to the front. But in these close quarters, it was impossible for anyone to give way. Shay peered ahead and noticed a sharp ray of light beyond the leaders. Apparently, the path was widening at last. They were nearly free of the pass of Noose. But then, just as Shay felt they had reached the safety of the other end, there were loud exclamations and the entire line came to a complete stop. Menyon's voice cut through the semi-darkness in surprise and anger, causing Alanon to mutter a low oath of fury and order the company to move ahead. For a moment, nothing happened. Then slowly the company began